October 29th. We passed a quiet night, although the pressure was grinding around us. Our floor is a heavy one, and it withstood the blows it received. There is a light wind from the northwest to north-northwest, and the weather is fine. We are 28 men with 49 dogs, including Sue's and Sally's 5 grown-up pups. All hands this morning were busy preparing gear, fitting boats on sledges, and building up and strengthening the sledges to carry the boats. The main motor sledge, with a little fitting from the carpenter, carried our largest boat admirably. For the next boat, 4 ordinary sledges were lashed together, but we were dubious as to the strength of this contrivance, and as a matter of fact it broke down quickly under strain. The ship is still afloat, with the spurs of the pack driven through her and holding her up. The forecastle head is under water, the decks are burst up by the pressure, the wreckage lies around in dismal confusion, but overall the blue ensign flies still. This afternoon Sally's 3 youngest pups, Sue's Sirius and Mrs. Chippy, the carpenter's cat, have to be shot. We could not undertake the maintenance of weaklings under the new conditions. Macklin, Crean and the carpenter seem to feel the loss of their friends rather badly. We propose making a short trial journey tomorrow, starting with 2 of the boats and the 10 sledges. The number of dog teams has been increased to 7, Greenstreet taking charge of the new additional team, consisting of Snapper and Sally's 4 oldest pups. We have 10 working sledges to relay with 5 teams. Wilde's and Hurley's teams will haul the cutter with the assistance of 4 men. The whaler and the other boats will follow, and the men who are hauling them will be able to help with the cutter at the rough places. We cannot hope to make rapid progress, but each mile counts. Crean this afternoon has a bad attack of snow blindness. The weather on the morning of October 30th was overcast and misty, with occasional falls of snow. A moderate northeasterly breeze was blowing. We were still living on extra food brought from the ship when we abandoned her, and the sledging and boating rations were intact. These rations would provide for 28 men for 56 days on full ration, but we could count on getting enough seal and penguin meat to at least double this time. We could even, if progress proved too difficult and too injurious to the boats, which we must guard as our ultimate means of salvation, camp on the nearest heavy floe, scour the neighbouring pack for penguins and seals, and await the outward drift of the pack to open and navigable water. This plan would avoid the grave dangers we are now incurring of getting entangled in impassable pressure ridges and possibly irretrievably damaging the boats, which are bound to suffer in rough ice. It would also minimize the peril of the ice splitting under us, as it did twice during the night at our first camp. Yet I feel sure that it is the right thing to attempt a march, since if we can make 5 or 7 miles a day to the northwest, our chance of reaching safety in the months to come will be increased greatly. There is a psychological aspect to the question also. It will be much better for the men in general to feel that, even though progress is slow, they are on their way to land, than it will be simply to sit down and wait for the tardy northwesterly drift to take us out of this cruel waste of ice. We will make an attempt to move. The issue is beyond my power either to predict or to control. That afternoon, Wilde and I went out in the mist and snow to find a road to the northeast. After many devious turnings to avoid the heavier pressure ridges, we pioneered away for at least 1.5 miles, and then returned by a rather better route to the camp. The pressure now was rapid in movement, and our floe was suffering from the shakes and jerks of the ice. At 3 p.m. after lunch, we got under way, leaving dump camp a mass of debris. The order was that personal gear must not exceed 2 pounds per man, and this meant that nothing but bare necessaries was to be taken on the march. We could not afford to cumber ourselves with unnecessary weight. Holes had been dug in the snow for the reception of private letters and little personal trifles, the lares and penates of the members of the expedition. And into the privacy of these white graves were consigned much of sentimental value, and not a little of intrinsic worth. I rather grudged the 2 pounds allowance per man, owing to my keen anxiety to keep weight at a minimum. But some personal belongings could fairly be regarded as indispensable. The journey might be a long one, and there was a possibility of a winter in improvised quarters on an inhospitable coast at the other end. A man under such conditions needs something to occupy his thoughts, some tangible memento of his home and people beyond the seas. So sovereigns were thrown away and photographs were kept. I tore the flyleaf out of the Bible that Queen Alexandra had given to the ship, with her own writing in it, and also the wonderful page of Job containing the verse, "Out of whose womb came the ice, and the hoary frost of heaven, who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." The other Bible, which Queen Alexandra had given for the use of the shore party, was down below in the lower hold in one of the cases when the ship received her death blow. Suitcases were thrown away. These were retrieved later as material for making boots, and some of them, marked solid leather, proved, to our disappointment, to contain a large percentage of cardboard. The manufacturer would have had difficulty in convincing us at the time that the deception was anything short of criminal. The pioneer sledge party, consisting of Wordy, Huzzy, Hudson, and myself, carrying picks and shovels, started to break a road through the pressure ridges for the sledges carrying the boats. The boats, with their gear and the sledges beneath them, weighed each more than a ton. The cutter was smaller than the whaler, but weighed more and was a much more strongly built boat. The whaler was mounted on the sledge part of the girling tractor forward, and two sledges amidships and aft. These sledges were strengthened with cross timbers and shortened oars fore and aft. The cutter was mounted on the aero sledge. The sledges were the point of weakness. It appeared almost hopeless to prevent them smashing under their heavy loads when travelling over rough pressure ice, which stretched ahead of us for probably 300 miles. After the pioneer sledge had started, the seven dog teams got off. They took their sledges forward for half a mile, then went back for the other sledges. Worsley took charge of the two boats, with 15 men hauling, and these also had to be relayed. It was heavy work for dogs and men, but there were intervals of comparative rest on the backward journey after the first portion of the load had been taken forward. We passed over two opening cracks, through which killers were pushing their ugly snouts, and by 5 p.m. had covered a mile in a north-northwesterly direction. The condition of the ice ahead was chaotic, for since the morning, increased pressure had developed and the pack was moving and crushing in all directions. So I gave the order to pitch camp for the night on flat ice, which, unfortunately, proved to be young and salty. The older pack was too rough and too deeply laden with snow to offer a suitable camping ground. Although we had gained only 1 mile in a direct line, the necessary deviations made the distance travelled at least 2 miles, and the relays brought the distance marched up to 6 miles. Some of the dog teams had covered at least 10 miles. I set the watch from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m., 1 hour for each man in each tent in rotation. During the night, snow fell heavily, and the floorcloths of the tents got wet through, as the temperature had risen to 25 degrees Fahrenheit. One of the things we hoped for in those days was a temperature in the neighbourhood of zero, for then the snow surface would be hard, we would not be troubled by damp, and our gear would not become covered in soft snow. The killers were blowing all night, and a crack appeared about 20 feet from the camp at 2 a.m. The ice below us was quite thin enough for the killers to break through if they took a fancy to do so, but there was no other camping ground within our reach, and we had to take the risk. When morning came, the snow was falling so heavily that we could not see more than a few score yards ahead, and I decided not to strike camp. A path over the shattered floes would be hard to find, and to get the boats into a position of peril might be disastrous. Rickinson and Worsley started back for dump camp at 7 a.m. to get some wood and blubber for the fire, and an hour later we had hoosh, with one biscuit each. At 10 a.m., Hurley and Hudson left for the old camp in order to bring some additional dog pemmican, since there were no seals to be found near us. Then, as the weather cleared, Worsley and I made a prospect to the west and tried to find a practicable road. A large floe offered a fairly good road for at least another mile to the northwest, and we went back prepared for another move. The weather cleared a little, and after lunch we struck camp. I took Rickinson, Carr, Wordy, and Hudson as a breakdown gang to pioneer a path among the pressure ridges. 5 dog teams followed. Wilds and Hurley's teams were hitched onto the cutter, and they started off in splendid style. They needed to be helped only once. Indeed, 14 dogs did as well or even better than 18 men. The ice was moving beneath and around us as we worked towards the big floe, and where this floe met the smaller ones, there was a mass of pressed-up ice, still in motion, with water between the ridges. But it is wonderful what a dozen men can do with picks and shovels. We could cut a road through a pressure ridge about 14 feet high in 10 minutes and leave a smooth, or comparatively smooth, path for the sledges and teams.